that you can't argue with 4 gold medals. That night, I ran like Jesse Owens through the dark March streets, leaning forward, arms and legs like pistons, head straight and still, hands loose, breathing controlled. And then I ran like Jesse Owens in gym on Thursday and came in before Danny, and in front of a whole lot of 8th graders. And I heard only one,
"Faster, you wimp!"
Just one. Running like Jesse Owens really worked. So that afternoon, at the very end of the day, after everyone else had left, I went up to Mrs. Baker's desk. "A big day for us both tomorrow," said Mrs. Baker. "The Ides of March," I said. "Let's hope we both emerge unscathed." Which, in case you missed it, was the teacher's strategy again to make me look up the word unscathed. "Mrs. Baker," I said, "you helped a lot with my running." "Thank you, Mr. Hood-Hood. So I thought I would try to pay you back." "Pay me back?" "Yes, to help you get ready for tomorrow, when the school board comes." "You want to coach me in teaching, Mr. Hood-Hood?" "Yes." "Have you ever been a 7th grade English teacher?" "No, but you've never been a track runner." Mrs. Baker raised a single eyebrow. "So what do you suggest, coach?" "No teacher jokes," I said. "No one ever laughs at teacher jokes." "All right, no teacher jokes. And no folding your arms, like this." I folded my arms across my chest. "It makes it look like you're about to shoot us if we don't do what you say." "That is the point," said Mrs. Baker. "And no rolling your eyes, even if someone says something really stupid." "I never roll my eyes," said Mrs. Baker. I looked at her. "All right," she said, "no rolling my eyes. Anything else, coach?" "When someone does something good, I think you should let them know, with some sort of code." "I think you mean that when someone does something well, as in obeying the rules of proper diction, we should use a code. What do you suggest?" "Well, maybe azalea for something good and chrysanthemum for something really good." "Thank you, Mr. Hood-Hood. We'll dispense with the code and I'll simply use the unvarnished English language to tell you when you've done something well. But as to teacher jokes, folding of arms and rolling of eyes, I'll consider your advice." I nodded. "And coach, one more thing before you leave," said Mrs. Baker. She reached into her lower desk drawer again and pulled out a wooden box. "Open it," she said. I did. Inside was a round silver disc on a velvet dark red ribbon. 16th Olympiad, Melbourne, 1956, it said. Mrs. Baker leaned back in her chair. It was for the women's 4x100 relay. "Don't look so surprised. You didn't think I'd spent my whole life behind this desk, did you?" And I suddenly realized that, well, I guess I had. Weren't all teachers born behind their desks, fully grown with a red pen in their hand and ready to grade? "Go home now, Mr. Hood-Hood," said Mrs. Baker. "And tomorrow, run like Jesse Owens." The Ides of March dawned on Friday with a green and brown sky, the color of the water in a dying pond. All morning, the sky hung low, and sometimes the green and brown clouds would roll up and rumble a bit, and then settle back down like a layer of unhappiness over everything. We all talked in whispers, and we waited for something to happen up in heaven, or maybe up in the asbestos ceiling tiles. And since waiting gets boring really quickly, I decided that in the pause between non-restrictive clauses and weak verb systems, I would tell Danny about the scene where Julius Caesar gets stabbed, which is a lot better than the scene where Juliet gets stabbed, and act it out with appropriate sound effects, which I do pretty well since I have some experience acting out Shakespeare on stage, as you might remember. I don't know if it was because of the green and brown sky or because of her cold or because of something else, but Mrs. Baker came over like Brutus himself to do Julius Caesar in. "Mr. Hood-Hood," she said, "I have not taught you the plays of William Shakespeare for the last 5 months for you to demean them by acting as though they were all about people stabbing each other." I thought that was unfair. "But they are," I said. "They do it all the time. Macbeth kills Duncan, Macduff kills Macbeth, Brutus kills Julius Caesar. Then when Brutus kills himself, like when Juliet kills herself after Romeo kills himself, but not before Romeo kills Tybalt." "And is that all you've learned from Shakespeare?" I thought that was unfair, too. Mrs. Baker held out her hand. "Give me the book," she said. I opened up my desk. Shakespeare is all about the power of goodness and honesty and faithfulness, she said. It is about the abundance of love. It is about the weakness of armies and battles and guns and... She stopped. Her mouth worked back and forth. It is about the endurance of love, she whispered. Give me the book. I handed it to her. At the same moment that the classroom door opened and Mr. Guareschi walked in, accompanied by Mr. Bradbrook and two other members of the school board. Mrs. Baker, said Mr. Guareschi. Mrs. Baker looked at him. Both of our hands were still on Shakespeare. Mrs. Baker, you know Mr. Bradbrook, of course, the chairman of the school board, and Mr. Smilzo, and you know Mrs. Sidman, who has just returned from Connecticut and been appointed to our school board. Mrs. Baker nodded to each one. How good to have you back, Mrs. Sidman, she said. Mrs. Sidman smiled. Her eyes darted around a little bit, like she was expecting something awful to happen, but didn't want to show that she was expecting it. Mrs. Baker is one of our very finest teachers, said Mr. Guareschi.
She will have a chance to show that to be true, said Mr. Bradbrook.
He pointed to the book that Mrs. Baker and I were still holding.
What are you giving to that young mind? He asked.
Mrs. Baker looked at me, then back at Mr. Bradbrook.
This is a volume of Shakespeare's plays, she said a little weakly. She let go of the book.
Mr. Bradbrook came over to my desk and peered at the book. Then he took it from me and weighed it in his hands. He looked at the gilt edges and fingered the red ribbon tied at the spine.
This seems like an awfully expensive volume for our schools to be purchasing, he said.
It is my own copy, said Mrs. Baker.
Mr. Bradbrook was relieved. He looked down at me.
Young man, do you think you'll enjoy reading the master's plays?
I already do, I said.
When I was a boy your age, said Mr. Bradbrook, I would memorize long passages and recite them whenever I was called upon to do so. When you read the master's lines, perhaps you too will be moved to memorize some. Perhaps one day you may even enact some.
I already have, I said.
Or perhaps Mrs. Baker will assign selected lines to you. Do you think that you might enjoy learning a line or two?
He patted the top of my head.
Really?
He reached out and patted the top of my head. Danny Hupford nearly fell out of his chair. He has already memorized quite a bit, said Mrs. Baker.
Has he? Said Mr. Bradbrook. He seemed sort of surprised. Well, let's hear some from the boy.
Mrs. Baker looked down at me. I couldn't really tell what was in her eyes. I thought at first that there might be a death threat, but either I'm getting used to them or that wasn't what was there. Howling Hood, do you know any lines or not?
That was from Mr. Guareschi.
And I almost said, you block, you stone, you worse than senseless thing, to him. But whatever it was in Mrs. Baker's eyes, it told me that that might not be the right thing to say. Probably a Caliban curse wouldn't work either. So I tried something else.
This was the noblest Roman of them all. All the conspirators save only he did that they did in envy of great Caesar. He only, in a general honest thought and common good to all, made one of them. His life was gentle, and the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, this was a man.
Merrill Lee clapped. Even Doug Swiatek clapped. I looked at Mrs. Baker's eyes.
Azalea, she said quietly.
What was that all about? Said Mr. Bradbrook.
The power of goodness and honesty and faithfulness, said Mrs. Baker. Now, if Mr. Guareschi will show you your seats, the class will work through the day's lesson. She went up to the board. This is the sentence you'll be diagramming, she said to us all, and wrote it out. You blocks, you stones, you worse than senseless things. Then she turned to us. Who can identify the implied verb? She asked. For the next hour, we did pretty well by Mrs. Baker. We answered everything she threw at us, and even Doug Swiatek helped out. He answered the implied verb question. And Mrs. Baker did her part, too. There were no teacher jokes, she never crossed her arms, and when Doug Swiatek,
who I guess thought he was in the rhythm after he got the implied verb question right, called Alfred Lord Tennyson, and you have to admit, it is a bizarre name. Alfred Lord Tennis. Mrs. Baker did not roll her eyes. Not even a little. It was an hour of pretty spectacular stuff. Let me tell you, we could have been America's Model Classroom of 1968. Mrs. Baker was so pleased that she even let me act out the stabbing scene from Julius Caesar after all, probably because she had forgotten all about the soothsayer business, which she shouldn't have, since when I got to the Et tu, Brute, then fall, Caesar, part, an asbestos ceiling tile over Mrs. Sidman's head that wasn't even bulging suddenly gave way, and it wasn't Julius Caesar who fell. It was Sycorax and Caliban who plummeted onto Mrs. Sidman's lap. I think that she was the only one in the classroom who did not scream, and I'm including Mr. Bradbrook and Mr. Guareschi in that. We all crashed over chairs and tables and desks to the sides of the classroom so that Mrs. Sidman was left completely alone, at her student desk, with two huge rats in her lap who were shaking their heads and trying to get some idea of what had just happened to them. Then, they pulled up their snouts and clacked their yellow teeth. Okay, so I panicked too. After living with the bulging ceiling tiles for all this time, we had gotten to believe they would never come down. But now we were face to face with huge, scabby, yellow-toothed, angry rats looking at us with eyes reddened with anger. And all we could think about was putting distance between us and them. And I want to point out for the record that it was members of the school board who were up on Mrs. Baker's desk first. Just about everyone else climbed the bookshelves and window shelf and radiators after throwing aside anything that got in our way. Except for two people. One was my T, who took off one of her shoes and stood beside her desk, ready to swing at anything that had yellow teeth. She looked as fierce as all get out. And the other was Mrs. Sidman, who I guess had determined that nothing more was going to happen to her at Camillo Junior High School without her say-so. She grabbed the rats by the back of their necks, which was not easy since they were so fat, pulled them off her lap, and hoisted them into the air. Their paws scrambled, their mouths hissed, their yellow teeth clicked. But Mrs. Sidman didn't care. She stood and held them up, like Macduff holding Macbeth's head. By now the screams, which had been increasing in volume, had brought Mr. Vinlairy. "Where do you want them?" asked the triumphant Mrs. Sidman.
"I've got a cage in the basement," he said.
"Lead the way," said Mrs. Sidman. And he went ahead of her, closing all of the classroom doors as he went. But I wish that everyone in Camillo Junior High could have seen her. The noblest school board member of them all. Mrs. Sidman, with her vanquished enemies still squirming in her hands, marching to the basement to dispatch them. While the school board members went to have an emergency meeting in Mr. Guareschi's office, we tried to put Mrs. Baker's classroom back together, since absolutely all of the desks had been knocked over. It took us most of the day to get everything right. Someone, I think it was Mr. Bradbrook, had knocked the globe of the world off Mrs. Baker's desk, and now there was a deep valley where the Himalaya Mountains had once been. The Red Thorndike dictionaries were going to need some help. Most of their covers had come off when we stepped onto them to climb higher up the bookshelves. And at least two of our desks were gone for good, since all of their legs had splayed out. Julius Caesar's army wouldn't have left such a mess after crossing the Rubicon. That afternoon, Coach Quattrini held his cross-country tryouts. By then, the story of Sycorax and Caliban was all over school, and so we figured that tryouts might be delayed. And it might be that some coaches somewhere would delay a tryout on an afternoon when some of the tryoutees have just been traumatized by two gigantic rats falling out of their classroom ceiling. But Coach Quattrini thought it would give us motivation.
"The big M," he said. "Motivation. You won't run fast unless you really want to run fast. And really wanting to run fast is what gives you motivation. The big M."
He had set out a course for us that stretched to some place beyond human endurance. We were supposed to start at the gym doors and go around the parking lot, where Sycorax and Caliban were hissing in their cage waiting for the exterminator to come put them in his truck, past the fence that enclosed the tennis courts, out onto Lee Avenue, down past Goldman's Best Bakery, around in front of the school by the main lobby, behind the elementary school wing, and so back to the gym doors.
Four times,
Coach Quattrini said, holding up four fingers.
You do that route four times, at tempo. Top seven will be varsity. That'll be all eighth graders, I expect. The rest of you will be junior varsity. If you're good enough to make that, you dang slugs.
And with that encouragement, Coach Quattrini blew his whistle, and we began. The sky had not improved during the day. The green and brown had swirled together, and the clouds had lowered themselves further and further, and they had dropped a kind of vapor from them that made it seem that we were running through the jungles of Vietnam and breathing more water than air. I leaned forward, and I kept my arms low and my hands loose. I didn't rush it. But even so, by the time I passed Sycorax and Caliban, who hissed and threw themselves against the bars toward me when I kicked their cage to say goodbye, I was already feeling the wet air welling inside me. By the time I came around for the second time, things were slowing down considerably, and every eighth grader, and a whole lot of the seventh graders, were far ahead of me. It's hard to run like Jesse Owens when you're feeling like you're drowning. The third lap was better. Marilee was standing by the main lobby, and when I ran past, she held up a dried rose with a ribbon on it. When a girl holds a rose up to you, you run better, let me tell you. By the time I came around for the fourth lap, I was up to Danny. I had even passed some of the eighth graders, and I could see the leaders in front of me again. I ran past the gym doors.
Can't you go any faster?
From Coach Quattrini, and out into the parking lot where the exterminator truck had pulled up to unload Sycorax and Caliban into their new cage. The sky had lowered itself even more, and everything looked like we were seeing it from underwater in a greenish haze. Even sounds were muffled so that my footsteps seemed to come from far away. But what wasn't muffled was the cry that came from the exterminator behind me, the sound of a large cage dropping, a scream, and the clicking of clacking teeth. I looked back, and there were the demon rats, racing with their scabby paws toward me, their eyes filled with the big M, murder, and their pointy heads bobbing up and down with each leap. I couldn't scream. I couldn't get enough air into my lungs for screaming. I could only run. But the faster I ran, the more their yellow hatred grew, and every time I looked back, which was a lot, they were flat out after me, their scabby whiskers swept back by their speed, their yellow teeth clacking. I could imagine those teeth sinking into my heels, like the assassin's daggers sinking into Caesar, and I ran faster. I'd be running still if the tennis courts hadn't been there. Since they were, I sprinted into the courts and kicked the wire gate closed behind me. Sycorax and Caliban smashed into the gate and poked their yellow scabby snouts through. Then they started to climb the fence. Really, they started to climb up the fence, never taking their red eyes off me. Fear can bring out the big M. I ran across the courts, and I was up and over the far side fence before they were up and over the near side one. By that time, Mr. Guareschi, who had heard all the screaming, was trying to get the exterminator to go inside the tennis courts to catch the rats. But the exterminator wouldn't go near them.
Did you see those teeth?
He said. He got into his truck and drove a safe distance away. Meanwhile, Sycorax and Caliban were climbing up the far side fence after me. Before they reached the ground outside, the entire schoolyard had emptied, me last, when Danny Hupfer grabbed me from where I'd been standing in paralyzed horror. So what happened after that is all a guess. At the same time that Sycorax and Caliban hit the bottom of the fence and ran into the parking lot looking for me, a school bus was coming back in for the late afternoon run. The driver later said that she saw the rats and tried to swerve, but that they leaped onto their hind legs and jumped in front of her. She slammed down on her brakes, but the rats stood their ground, their paws up, their snouts pulled back, their yellow teeth clacking, their demon eyes flashing, none of which you'd have been able to recognize among the squashed bits when the bus, after skidding on the suddenly slick asphalt, finally came to a stop. And as the exterminator drove away, since there was nothing more for him to do, the green and brown sky finally opened, and the rain came down in torrents, so fast it blew sideways, and when it had raged for about the time it takes to run 2 laps around Camillo Junior High, it stopped, and the green sky evaporated, and it was the Ides of March, a beautiful spring day. A new record was set for the 3-mile run for a Long Island school that afternoon, and I'm including high schools here. People said afterward that they had never seen anything like it, that kind of speed from a 7th grader. So I made the varsity team and had the big M to keep running, especially since it stayed beautiful for the rest of March as the days grew longer, so long that it was still light when my father and sister came home from Hood Hood and Associates at supper time. I practiced every afternoon after school with the other varsity runners, me the only 7th grader, while the sun was yellow and warm and the sky blue and white. I ran leaning forward, my arms and legs like pistons, head straight and still, hands loose, breathing controlled. I ran like Jesse Owens with the big M. Meanwhile, the story of the rats grew larger. People went to visit the spot where they had met the bus. Doug Swiatek's brother had 2 teeth that he claimed were from Caliban, and he would show them to you for a quarter. Mrs. Sidman was the most heroic figure of the story, and even 1st graders were drawing pictures of her carrying Caliban and Sycorax through the halls of Camillo Junior High. In all of those pictures, she looked like the warrior that Ariel had wanted to be, stern and serious and powerful. A 3rd grader drew a coat of arms for her with 2 dead rats beneath her feet. Charles, the 5th grader of the lovely handwriting, inscribed the motto beneath, "To the death." The D had a whole lot of swirling loops inside it. The only one who came out badly in the stories was my T, and honestly, I couldn't figure it out. No one but my T had stood her ground beside Mrs. Sidman while all the rest of us scrammed across the room. But instead of her getting a coat of arms and being made into a warrior, people started to talk about her, and not just behind her back, but so that she could hear them. About how people in Vietnam ate rats. How she was just hoping for a good meal. How she thought they were rat burgers on the run. Stuff like that. Until one day, when outside the yellow forsythia branches were weaving themselves together, and the daffodils were playing their trumpets, and the lilacs were starting to bud and getting all giddy, we were going through the lunch line, and Mrs. Biggio handed my tea her tuna casserole surprise. And one of the penitentiary-bound 8th graders said loudly to Mrs. Biggio,
"Don't you have any rat surprise for her?"
And then he turned to Mighty and said,
"Why don't you go back home where you can find some?"
And then Mighty started to cry. Just stood there crying. And Danny took his entire tray, which was filled with tuna casserole surprise and 2 glasses of chocolate milk and red jello with peaches, and dumped it over the penitentiary-bound 8th grader's stupid head, and then, before the 8th grader could open his stupid eyes to see who had done it, Danny punched him as hard as he could and broke his stupid nose. Which got Danny a 4-day suspension. Which Mr. and Mrs. Hupfer used to take him to Washington, D.C., because they were so proud of him. At lunch recess, on the day he came back, he told us about climbing the Washington Monument, touring the White House, seeing Hubert Humphrey waving from a limousine, sprinting up the Capitol steps 3 at a time, running at tempo through the maze of fences the police were putting up to control the demonstration that Martin Luther King Jr. was bringing to Washington next month, and walking up to President Lyndon Baines Johnson and shaking his hand, all of which we believed except for the last part. But this next part is no lie. When we got back in from recess, Mrs. Biggio and Mrs. Baker were holding 2 trays filled with fried bananas. Really, fried bananas rolled in crushed nuts dipped in coconut and topped with caramel sauce. Warm caramel sauce. Can you imagine what all 4 of those together smelled like? Sweet and fruity and spicy and warm and creamy and chewy all at the same time. That's about as close as I can get. It's the kind of smell that makes you hungry just thinking about it. Mrs. Baker held the tray like she was carrying gold and frankincense and myrrh. "It's a recipe from Vietnam," she said. Mrs. Biggio has made them for our class. We cheered. The caramel sauce is called Nuoc Mao. Did I say that correctly, Mai Ti Huang? Mai Ti shrugged and smiled, and Mrs. Baker laughed, and then she and Mrs. Biggio walked up and down the aisles, and we each took a plate with a fried banana smothered in caramel sauce on it. And when Mrs. Biggio got to Mai Ti, she stopped and lifted a plate down onto her desk and said, "I am so sorry, Mai Ti. I am so sorry." That night, Walter Cronkite reported that in Kaesan, some of the tunnels the Viet Cong were digging now reached to within 50 yards of the marine fences. There were more mortar shells lobbed in. There were more pictures of the Marines deep in their bunkers with their hands over their ears. Casualties were light, the White House announced. In Camillo Junior High, we ate fried bananas with warm Nuoc Mao. We sang a song that Mai Ti taught us about bananas, though it could have been about elephants and we wouldn't have known it, since we only knew two words of Vietnamese. And when we were done, Mrs. Biggio and Mai Ti held each other tightly, and it seemed to all of us that they did not want to let go. April. The next week, Mrs. Sidman read the names of the seven members of the Camillo Junior High School varsity cross-country team during morning announcements. "We are very glad to have these seven students represent our school," said Mrs. Sidman. "Most especially Holland Hoodhood, who will represent the seventh grade. Holland came in with the fastest time during tryouts, almost a minute faster than any of the eighth graders on the team. We wish you all luck, boys." This was frightening. It was the kind of stuff that makes you hope that you are never alone in the locker room with the other guys on your team. And there wasn't much help from anyone in Mrs. Baker's class.
"I wonder why Holling had the fastest time," said Danny after the announcements, a whole lot louder than he had to. "Could it be because he was running away from two rats who were trying to eat him?"
"That might have had a little to do with it," I said.
"A little," said Danny.
"A little," said Mary Lee.
"A little," said Mai Ti.
"A very little," I said, and everyone in the class ripped out a piece of paper from their notebooks, scrunched it up, and threw it at me, which was unfair since you can't stop 22 pieces of scrunched up paper at the same time. You pretty much know from what I just told you that Mrs. Baker wasn't in the room. She'd been called down to the office for a phone call before morning announcements, and she'd had Mr. Van Leary stay with us while she was gone, which was why balls of scrunched-up paper surrounded my desk by the time Mrs. Baker came back, and since generally the person who is surrounded by balls of scrunched-up paper will be the person blamed for all the balls of scrunched-up paper, I figured I would be the one who had to pick them all up. That's how it is in the world. But not this time. Because the phone call in the office was from the United States Army. The Viet Cong had abandoned Kaesan, and 20,000 American troops were marching to relieve the Marines and to find missing American soldiers, like Lieutenant Baker. "It will be called," Mrs. Baker told us, "Operation Pegasus. Now, someone tell me the meaning of the classical allusion." She never did say anything about all the balls of scrunched-up paper around my desk. You may have noticed, too, that it was Mrs. Sidman who read the morning announcements over the PA instead of Mr. Guareschi. That was because Mr. Guareschi was gone. Mrs. Baker had told us he had received an administrative reassignment, but that only meant that he was gone, and Mrs. Sidman was our new principal.
Really?
I suppose the school board figured that if Mrs. Sidman could pick up two huge rats by the scruff of their necks and carry them through the halls, she could certainly handle middle schoolers, which was probably true. No one saw Mr. Guareschi leave, still looking for a small country to be dictator of. But everyone saw Mrs. Sidman on the first day she was principal. She stood in the main lobby and watched us come in. She already knew almost all of our names, and she must have said, "Good morning," 300 times. She stood straight, with her arms folded across her chest, which, as any teacher coach will tell you, isn't good for teachers, but probably isn't bad for principals. I heard that she even stared down Doug Swiatek's brother. While Mrs. Sidman was starting up her new job at Camillo Junior High, President Lyndon B. Johnson was giving up his old one at the White House. Walter Cronkite carried the announcement the last day of March. President Johnson said that he did not want to be distracted by partisan politics.
With America's sons in the fields far away, with America's future under challenge right here at home.
He had decided that he would not run for the presidency again. His whole face seemed to sag down as he said this. "He doesn't want to be humiliated," said my sister at the first commercial that night. "He knows he can't win against Bobby Kennedy."
"He knows he can't win against Richard Nixon," said my father. "Not with the whole war on his back."
"Either way, he's getting out because he doesn't want to lose, not because he cares about America's future." My father sighed a loud sigh.
"So is that how all flower children make their judgments? So quick and easy?"
"When they're quick and easy to make," said my sister. Only the end of the commercial stopped what could have gotten a whole lot louder. I seemed to see President Johnson's sagging face through the rest of the news. Banquo's face probably looked a whole lot like that just before Macbeth had him killed, when he suddenly realized that everything that he had hoped for was crashing down. And then on top of that, we found out after the CBS Evening News that President Johnson wasn't the only one giving up his job.
"Kowalski's finished too," said my father.
We all looked at him. "What do you mean?" said my mother.
"Finished," said my father. "Done. Over. Washed up. Kaput. I told you he couldn't play for keeps. They'll announce it in a couple of weeks or so. No more Kowalski and Associates. We'll be the only architectural firm in town that matters."
He looked at me.
"I told you we'd be going places if we got the junior high job, didn't I?"
I nodded. He had told me. "What about the Kowalskis?" I asked. My father shrugged.
"Architecture is a blood sport," he said.
So at lunch recess the next day, Marilee and I spent a lot of time not saying anything, until Marilee said it for us. "I might be moving," she said. I looked at her. "I'll probably be moving."
"Where?"
I said. "To my grandmother's house? In Kingston?" I nodded. Another minute or so of not saying anything went by. I knew I should say something. I guess after reading all that Shakespeare, I should know what to say. But I didn't have a single word. So Marilee said it for us again. "Toads, beetles, bats," she said. And that was exactly right. Marilee didn't know how long she had left. Maybe just 2 or 3 weeks. So we decided to pretend that it was forever, and we didn't talk about it, and we tried not to think about it. But there were those moments when one of us would look at the other, and we knew what we were thinking, even though we wouldn't say it. Probably sort of how it was between Romeo and Juliet. It helped to run hard. So hard that you can't think about much of anything else because your arteries are all opened out as far as they can be, looking for some oxygen, any oxygen, because you can't pull enough air into your lungs, and there's this coach who has invented an entirely new vocabulary to wrap around the word
faster,
a vocabulary that even Caliban would have blushed at. We ran for more miles a day than most commuters drive. We ran through neighborhoods that I don't think are even in Nassau County. We ran past other junior high schools and got jeered at by baseball players who warmed up with a couple of sprints and then shagged balls the rest of the afternoon. We ran past the red tulips in front of St. Adalbert's and the white lilacs in front of Temple Bethel. We ran past Goldman's Best Bakery and smelled the latest batch of cream puffs sending their scent through the open windows. One day we ran all the way to Jones Beach, and if Mrs. Sidman hadn't sent a bus after us, I think we would have collapsed on the boardwalk and died. But I was getting faster, really, even though I stayed at the back of the pack of eighth graders. Let me tell you, when you're in the seventh grade, it isn't healthy to run at the front of a pack of eighth graders. I did it once, and they pulled my shorts down to my ankles in mid-stride. You don't let something like that happen twice. You stay at the back of the pack, and you learn the telltale signs of someone ahead of you who is about to spit off to the side. Danny understood this too, since he ran behind the 8th graders on the junior varsity team, and they were angry 8th graders. Angry 8th graders with plenty of spit. Mrs. Baker did not understand why I was running behind anyone. She decided to give me a month off Shakespeare to coach me, since developing the body as well as the mind, she said, was a humane and educational activity. Every Wednesday, she timed a 3-mile run, and I was dropping a couple of minutes with each one. This didn't include the time I made when Sycorax and Caliban were chasing me, when I think I might have beaten Jesse Owens. My lean was better, Mrs. Baker said, and my arms a lot looser. But she still wanted to work on my breathing, and so after the 3 miles, we did wind sprints until I almost threw up, which makes you want to get your breathing better in a hurry. Mrs. Baker didn't care that I had regular practice on Wednesday afternoons, after school, with Coach Quattrini. If you want to get better, you run, she said. You can't possibly run too much. Which I do not think is true, but probably is some sort of teacher strategy. Mary Lee didn't understand why I was running at all, since it meant I wasn't working on the California Gold Rush and You project, and she'd already written all the notes for our report and started on the contour map. Don't think a rose and a Coke are going to get you out of this, she said, which I already knew. Remember, I'm not a jerk like Romeo. And that was why one afternoon I was in Mary Lee's kitchen, working on making the California Gold Rush relevant to you, when Mr. Kowalski came home and told us what he had heard on the car radio. That Martin Luther King Jr., who was in Memphis helping striking sanitation workers, had been shot and killed. He died, Mr. Kowalski said, just after he had asked a friend to play Precious Lord, Take My Hand. Mary Lee took my hand and we went into the living room, where Walter Cronkite was just finishing the news. He told us that it was all horribly true. I thought he was shaking.
Nothing will ever be the same, said Mr. Kowalski.
Mary Lee squeezed my hand, hard. That night, my sister would not come down to supper, and my father did not call her down. He sat with a face as grim as President Johnson's. Every so often, he would look up the stairs to my sister's room, then back down at his lima beans.
How could this happen? He said.
The next day, there were riots in Chicago, in Savannah, in Washington, in Toledo, in Detroit, in Pittsburgh, and in New York.
We are coming apart, my father said.
And on Tuesday, while everyone at Camillo Junior High watched on the television in the gym, my father stayed home from Hood Hood and Associates to watch on our television 2 Georgia mules draw the old green farm wagon that carried the body of Martin Luther King Jr. through the streets of Atlanta. He didn't say a thing at supper. Neither did my sister. Just before I went to bed that night, I reminded my father that the next day was opening day at Yankee Stadium. You probably remember how we got the tickets. And he had promised to drive me there to meet Danny and his father, and Doug and his father, and to write a note to get me out of Coach Quattrini's cross-country practice for that day, and to let me leave before school ended.
Isn't there enough happening in the world that you shouldn't have to go into the city for a baseball game?
He said. It's opening day, I said. He shook his head. He never did write the note. So I wrote it myself and got him to sign it in the morning. I told him that he needed to pick me up at 12 noon sharp since the game began at 2.
Sure, sure, he said,
which were the same words that Coach Quattrini used when I showed him the note.
You expect me to believe that your father wrote this?
He said. I wrote the note, he signed it, I said.
Did he read it before he signed it?
No, you pied ninny. You blind mole, I wanted to say. He didn't read it. He just signs whatever I ask him to sign, like blank checks with lots of numbers to the left of the decimal point. Yes, I said. Coach Quattrini scrunched the paper in a ball and threw it at me.
I won't go easy on you at the next practice, he said,
as if this was something I hadn't already counted on. Mrs. Baker figured that since I was leaving early, I should do the whole day's work in the morning. When I pointed out that neither Danny nor Doug was even in class and that they were probably taking the whole day off and maybe they were sitting in Yankee Stadium already watching batting practice with Horace Clark and Joe Pepitone hitting them out a mile, Mrs. Baker pointed out that run-on sentences were improper and I would do well to get started on the non-restrictive clauses worksheet. Which I did, since the prospect of opening day at Yankee Stadium made even non-restrictive clauses bearable. And it probably helped that Danny and Doug would have to do all the work the next day anyway. By the time noon came, my hands were blue with the fresh Ditto ink, but I had finished every non-restrictive clause exercise and done the reading comprehension, and even done more to make the California Gold Rush relevant to you by pointing out the perils of the love of money in a brilliantly worded argument for Mr. Petrelli, which I handed Mrs. Baker while everyone went out to lunch recess. "Why don't you take this down to his room?" she said. "By that time, your father will be here." So I did, and Mr. Petrelli made me stand there by his desk as he read it over, as he pointed out the powerful use of non-restrictive clauses, as he advised against the use of clichés, and as he identified more than one historical inaccuracy, and as I squirmed, imagining my father standing in his three-piece suit by Mrs. Baker's desk, large and important, the Chamber of Commerce businessman of 1967, and probably 1968, too. When Mr. Petrelli finished, I hurried back to Mrs. Baker's room, since I wasn't sure that I wanted my father to be standing there being large and important. But I didn't need to hurry, since when I got to the room, my father wasn't standing by Mrs. Baker's desk. We both looked up at the clock. 12:11. 11 lousy minutes after 12, and he wasn't here yet. I ran down to the main administrative office and called Hoodhood and Associates. "I'm sorry," said his secretary. "Mr. Hoodhood has been out at the site of the new junior high school all day, and he isn't expected back until 2:30. "He has a baseball game at 2 o'clock," I said. "No, he has an important meeting with the Chamber of Commerce scheduled for 4:30. He wouldn't miss a Chamber of Commerce meeting for a baseball game." She was right. He wouldn't. I hung up the phone and went back to the classroom. Mrs. Baker was reading in her Shakespeare book when I came back. "Oh," she said when she saw me. She looked up at the clock. "Oh," she said again. Mary Lee came back into the room. She stood at the door when she saw me. "Aren't you?" And then she stopped. Because apparently, I wasn't. One by one, everyone came back from lunch recess. One by one, they looked at me and knew what had happened. And what was there to say? I sat down at my desk, as humiliated as President Johnson would have been if he had lost to Bobby Kennedy. My heart beat against my chest. I was surprised that no one else could hear it. I suppose there may have been a more miserable hour sometime in my life, but I couldn't think of what it might have been. Until 1:55, when everyone had left for Temple Beth-El or St. Adalbert's, and Mrs. Baker said, "Mr. Hoodhood, I think I could get you there for some of the game." The sweetest words e'er spoken. I almost cried. I took the two tickets out of my shirt pocket and held them up. "Have you ever been to a Yankee game, Mrs. Baker?" "Never intentionally," she said. "Call your mother and see if it's all right." Which I did, except she wasn't home, so I called my sister at high school. "You're calling me at school for that? Why should I care what time you'll be back?" she said, which I figured was good enough. And that was how Mrs. Baker and I found ourselves on the Long Island Expressway driving toward New York City, me looking at my watch every 3 minutes or so, and Mrs. Baker moving along at a steady 45 miles per hour in a 60-mile-per-hour zone. "You can go up to 65 without getting a ticket," I pointed out. "I tend not to want to see how far I can break the law before I'm caught." "You drove a lot faster than this to the hospital." "Much faster, but I was going to the hospital. Today I am driving to a baseball game." "On opening day, it's just as important," I said. "And I just saw you roll your eyes." "I never roll my eyes," said Mrs. Baker. "But if I did roll my eyes, that would have been an appropriate time to do so." The whole way, she never passed 45. She fussed at the Whitestone Bridge toll to get the right change, and she fussed at the parking lot because she wanted to find a space with no cars on either side, which there weren't any of within 3 miles, and that was about how far away we parked. And we didn't run to Yankee Stadium in 7-minute miles, let me tell you. So it was the bottom of the third inning by the time that Mrs. Baker and I reached our box seats, which were on the first baseline right next to the Yankee dugout. You could make out every pinstripe on every uniform, we were that close. Mr. Hupfer got up and let me sit in front with Danny and Doug, and he sat behind us with Mrs. Baker and Mr. Swiatek. And Danny never asked about Mrs. Baker being there, even though I knew he wanted to. But I didn't care anymore, because it was April, and it was opening day at Yankee Stadium, and the California Angels were out in the field, and the Yankees were up at bat. The game was everything it was supposed to be. Horace Clark turned a double play off his heel, and Joe Pepitone caught a pop fly over his shoulder. Frank Fernandez had hit the only home run in the second inning, so we'd missed it, which was a big deal since it won the game, and Mel Stottlemyre threw a 4-hit shutout. Mickey Mantle had 2 singles, so Danny and I couldn't boo him like we wanted to. And when Horace Clark came out of the dugout for the 7th-inning stretch, he tossed 3 balls to us, and we almost had another one off a Mickey Mantle foul ball, except it hit the bar along the box seats and skipped over us. And Mr. Hupfer and Mr. Swiatek bought us all, even Mrs. Baker, hot dogs with sauerkraut and more hot dogs with sauerkraut, and Cokes in bottles with the ice still frozen to them, and pretzels as big as both your hands together, and then another hot dog with sauerkraut for each of us. And we shouted and hollered when the bum ump made a lousy call on Joe Pepitone that made him strike out, and everybody, even Mrs. Baker, stood and cheered when Mel Stottlemyre retired 10 batters in a row. It was just swell. But what happened afterward? That was just swell, too. Joe Pepitone and Horace Clark yelled up to our box at the end of the game.
"Hey, Danny, Howling Doug," they called, just like that. "Hey, Danny, Howling Doug."
There wasn't a kid within earshot that didn't wish that they were us.
"Hey,"
we called back.
"You want to come down on the field?"
asked Horace Clark, which we didn't need to answer because we were already climbing over the railing. That was when Joe Pepitone saw Mrs. Baker.
"You're that dame that got us to come out to the school last December," he said.
Let me tell you, I wasn't sure Mrs. Baker had ever been called that dame before, and I was sure she wasn't all that happy about it now. Mrs. Baker crossed her arms over her chest, even though I had coached her against that. "Yes," she said, "though it was my brother-in-law who contacted you." She said it in this frozen voice that would have quieted any 7th-grade class in 1/2 a second. But Joe Pepitone didn't notice. He took a step closer.
"Aren't you that dame that ran in Melbourne? The woman's 4x100. You anchored, right?"
I was really sure that Mrs. Baker had never been called that dame twice in 2 sentences that came one after the other. "Yes," she said.
"I saw that race. You were in 5th place when you got the baton, and you almost made it all up in the last 100. You came in something like 0.3 of a second behind?"
2/10, said Mrs. Baker.
"Hey, Horace," said Joe Pepitone. "Do you know who this is? Get Hauk over here and see if he remembers that dame we saw anchor the 4x100 relay in Melbourne. And get Cox over here, too."
And that was why when the photographers came to take pictures after the game, they found most of the Yankees around that dame with the legs that almost made up 5 places in the Melbourne Olympic Games in just 100 meters. And after she ran the race with them again 5 times over, she asked the Yankees to show us around the stadium, and they did. Really. Joe and Horace took us up in the bleachers and to the sky-high seats, and then down beneath to the locker rooms, which Mrs. Baker did not go in, and around to the offices, and then through the dugout and back onto the field. The people who were still up in the stands saw me and Danny pitch to Joe Pepitone, with Jake Gibbs catching, and I don't think Mrs. Baker rolled her eyes once. And afterward,
I ran around all the bases, from home to first to second to third and back to home, and then I ran to the outfield and sprinted from right to left and then back again. And all the while, the green grass and the yellow diamond dust were in my nose, and the sun lowering over Yankee Stadium shone down on me, Holling Hoodhood, playing center field for the New York Yankees and waiting for the crack of the bat. When you have the chance to run the outfield of Yankee Stadium, and you're not exactly sure if you'll ever have another chance, you have to take things as they come. I ran back to pitch my last pitches. The sun was getting low by the time Joe Pepitone had smacked them out, and Mrs. Baker stood at home plate surveying the place like she was considering buying it. "What is all that scaffolding up there for?" she asked. Maybe she was considering buying it.
"Repairs," said Joe. "Lots of places in the stadium need repairs. They're waiting on the boss to find an architect."
"An architect?" said Mrs. Baker.
"Someone classical, the boss says. Real classical."
"I'd like to meet him," said Mrs. Baker.
"If you can hit my fastball," said Mel Stottlemyre, "I'll take you up to meet him."
Mrs. Baker looked at me and rolled her eyes. "Get me a bat, Mr. Hoodhood," she said. It turned out that Mr. Hupford drove me and Danny home that night. Mrs. Baker stayed to meet the boss. Mrs. Baker's picture was in the Hometown Chronicle 2 days later, standing next to Danny and Doug and me, and all of us surrounded by smiling Yankee players. I wore Joe Pepitone's jacket to school, and Danny wore his hat, and Doug wore Horace Clark's hat. 3 sixth graders asked for my autograph on a baseball, which I gave them. Coach Quattrini, however, did not ask for an autograph. He kept his promise, and the next cross-country practice was about as hard as two practices put together. And since he believed in democracy, he said, he figured that everyone should have the same cross-country practice. And so all 7 of the varsity runners ran like Brutus and Cassius were after them with long and pointy knives. The 8th graders loved me after that. They threw all of my clothes in the showers, and I walked home leaving puddles at every step. So when spring break finally came, it dropped as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. Spring break. Were there any two words ever put together that make a more beautiful sound? Spring break. Let me tell you, the days were warm and green. Danny, Mitey, Merrily, and I met at Woolworth's in the afternoons. We ordered Cokes and hamburgers for as long as our allowances held out. Spring break. The high school was out too, and so my sister was always in a happy, happy mood. She had a new friend named Chit, that really was his name, and he drove a yellow VW Bug with bright pink and orange flower decals. He was mostly legs and arms and hair, and he came over every afternoon and would go down into the basement with my sister, and they would listen to her transistor radio, and then come upstairs singing about yellow submarines very loudly and laughing like it was the funniest thing in the world. Afterward, Chit would fold himself into his yellow Bug, and my sister would go driving around with him. Spring break. Warm and green days. You know they aren't going to last, but when you start in on them, they're like a week of summer plunked down as a gift in the middle of junior high school. They mean the smell of dust and grass on a baseball diamond, the first fresh sea breezes that come all the way inland from Long Island Sound, all the maples decked out in green gold leaves. They mean checking the tennis rackets to see if winter has warped them while they hung in the garage, and watching the first rabbit running across the lawn, and neighbors putting the first free kitten signs up on their stoops. That's spring break. You come back to school thinking that it's no longer just the end of winter. It's almost the beginning of summer, and you figure that you can hang on until the end of June, because the warm breezes are coming in the window like quiet happiness. Coach Quattrini had made us swear on the lives of our firstborn children that we would run hard during spring break. He promised he would find out if we missed one day, just one day, and that we would pay dearly. So when we got back to school, he began the first practice with this announcement. Every runner on the varsity team was going to have to better my tryout time with the Rats by 35 seconds. No exceptions. And no Rats to help. Let me tell you, the eighth graders were not happy. Once we got started on our run, there was a whole lot of spitting to the side timed with the wind, which I had to keep watch for. And I kept well to the back of the pack, since we ran through neighborhoods where there were kids from school who knew me, and I didn't want to find myself in front of their houses with my shorts pulled down to my ankles. I was glad that Doug Swiatek's brother wasn't a varsity runner. Who knew what would have happened then? It was when we were all back from the run that first day, and standing around the gym doors trying not to die, that Coach Quattrini gave his second announcement. There was going to be a Long Island Junior High School cross-country meet this spring, just to work up excitement for the fall season.
"It's this Saturday, so you're all going to have to get up early and miss your cartoons," he said. "I feel really badly about that. So badly I could cry. Boo-hoo. Be here by 7. Bus leaves